Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Jay Ross, Soul Cravers Radio. And today I have my good friend and my musical brother, music journalist A. Scott Galloway. Hey, A. Scott, what's going on?
What's going on, Jay Ross? Happy Super Bowl Sunday to you, man. How you feeling?
Oh, same here, too. I know it's a lot. I mean, these streets are crazy right now, so I'm just trying to get everything together right now because the Super Bowl is, like, major right now. So, yeah.
Man, no doubt, man. I'm just sitting here chilling over a dear friend's house, having some champagne. We just had some little brunch items that she made and looking forward to our chat. And then when we're done, me, who is not a sports person, is going to actually go to a sports bar and hang out and check out at least half of the Super Bowl. Because, you know, I got to see J-Lo and Shakira do their thing. And then after that, you know, I probably don't even care how the game ends. I just, you know, I just kind of got to put my eyes on them Latina ladies and see how they throw it down for the Super Bowl.
Anybody that knows A. Scott Galloway, he's a music journalist. I mean, he has a massive career that he's been writing for years, like since 1988. So how did all this play a part to you being a journalist?
Well, I've just always been a music lover, you know, ever since I was born, basically. You know, my parents had wonderful record collection, and I, you know, got knee-deep into it. I'm a drummer. You know, I studied music, and I worked in radio. I've worked in retail. And after I was doing all of that, I kind of got an opportunity to work at an industry-only publication called Urban Network Magazine. At the time, that was run by the late, great Jerry Bolden. And, you know, I got a lot of wonderful opportunities there. You know, I spent, from 88 to into the millennium, you know, working for that company. And it gave me an opportunity to interview a lot of people, to review a lot of concerts, review a lot of records and things. And just through doing things over and over and over and over again, you know, I just kind of built my skills up. I was very lucky. And I got into my niche, which was writing liner note essays for CDs, when my good friend David Nathan asked me to come and do some stuff. Or he just told me that he was doing some – this is when Rhino had just purchased the Atlantic Records catalog. And he said, you know, he was doing all this stuff on – all the divas and stuff. And I said, hey, man, you know, if they ever do something on Average White Band, I would love to write about them because, you know, I love bands. I've been in bands. I'm a drummer, and Steve Ferroni is one of my favorite drummers, and he's a drummer for Average White Band. The next week, I got a call from Rhino saying that they needed somebody to write about AWB. And since that point, I've written over 300 liner note essays.
Yeah, and when I looked at your liner notes, I mean, everything is so detailed. It's like you're storytelling, but it's actually the artist that's telling the story. And then you like, the flow just is amazing with the liner notes. And I'm a big fan of liner notes. That's why I buy a lot of reissued CDs. And shout out to all the reissue companies that's doing this, because as music and lovers like me and you, we need this, you know. And when we look at the liner notes, it's just pretty much, it's like a story, because you could outlive like what was going on around that time. But it's more into but you go real depth into the behind the scenes. Like this one you reissue, my girl Phyllis Hyman, the Deliver the Love album, and the song for As You Are that was featured on Pharrell Sanders' Love Will Find a Way album, which I think that was like one of his best commercial work ever. And and when you went into going into the song, how Phyllis was doing it, I didn't know that Phyllis went through that many tries with that song. It was like, wow.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, when I first started doing liner notes, I was not happy with a lot of the other writers that were doing them at the time, because they weren't taking the time to go back and talk to people. And I'm probably overly alpha with that kind of stuff, because, you know, where most people, if they're doing a Phyllis Hyman project, they might interview two or three people.
Right.
You know, I end up interviewing 20. And so that story that you're talking about, where we're talking about As You Are, the brother, I forgot his full name, but his first name is Paul, that wrote that song. I got a hold of him. I got a hold of Norman Connors, who produced the song, and I got a hold of Pharoah Saunders, which was a real coup. He doesn't do that many interviews, man. But, you know, he felt my passion. I got him to speak about Phyllis. And this is what it's all about, man, because, you know, and, you know, for instance, there's already been a book written about Phyllis Hyman called Strength of a Woman. And, you know, and when somebody writes a book about somebody, they tend to go into a whole lot of the personal aspects of the person, their struggles, their highs and lows of their life. But they're not going to go knee deep into the story of how, you know, this particular song got recorded by Phyllis Hyman and what the recording session was like and how Phyllis responded to the song and why the songwriter wrote it and why Norman Connors, the producer, picked it and all that stuff. That's not going to be in a book. So that's where liner notes really come in. If you're really serious about your craft, I've always felt that that's the kind of depth that you need to go into, because nobody else is going to do it. And guess what? If you don't talk to these people while they're here, you look up and they're gone. And I've been so blessed. I mean, there's so many people I've literally, Jay, I've talked to people and 1 month later, they were gone. It's like I just got them for whatever project I was working on. I finally got a chance to talk to, like, when I was doing liner notes for the Dells and the classic album Freedom Means, one of the people I talked to for that project was a drummer. Why is his name escaping me? He was a drummer for himself, Morris Jennings. Morris Jennings was his name. I'm a drummer. I love Morris Jennings. I never had a reason to knock on his door, bang on, you know, hey, I'd love to talk to you. That Dells project came up, and I finally got to talk to him. I talked to him for an hour. We only talked about the Dells for 10 minutes, but I talked to him for an hour, and I was so happy. And do you know, a month later, he was gone. So, you know, I really feel strongly, strongly about talking to these folks. They love to share their history, and too many people don't reach out to them, you know. So that's a very, very important aspect of what I do and why I do it.
And I think with your liner notes, you go to the behind the scenes, the actual session players of the album, which they could pretty much relate to the working of the projects. And when you did a lot of projects and the liner notes for them, I just was like, wow. I mean, you went to everyone that was involved with it. And to you to share your stories that the people that's not there, it's just amazing that you reach out to these people and they take the time out. Because a lot of artists these days, especially the ones that were behind the scenes, they don't want to, you know, tell their stories. And you...
I think a lot of the behind-the-scenes people actually do appreciate when somebody cares enough to get their opinion, because too oftentimes it's only the stars, you know, the artist, maybe the record producer, you know, that people will go to. You know, and even again, one of the first liner note projects that I did was on the band Average White Band, like I said earlier. Most people would have only talked to Alan Gorey and Hamish Stewart. Why? Because they were the two lead singers of the group.
Exactly.
But when I did my liner note essay, I talked to Alan and Hamish and drummer Steve Ferroni and both horn players, Roger Ball and Malcolm Duncan, and the rhythm guitar player, Ani McIntyre. When I did their live album, I talked to their roadie. When I talked to their producer, Arif Mardin. You know, I mean, it's like I talked to Arif Mardin, you know, and Arif Mardin's gone. You know, I interviewed Arif for Average White Band and Donnie Hathaway. Again, another legendary person. He was very busy at the time. He's working on Norah Jones and who knows what else, you know. But he took 10 minutes to talk to me, and I cherish those 10 minutes, you know, like you wouldn't believe. But I find most people are willing to talk to you if they know that you're serious about what you're doing. And you have a passion, they'll give you a little bit of time. It's like their way of giving back. And so, you know, I'm never going to try to ignore the stars. You know, you got to get the star people, but I fortify my work by reaching out to as many other people that were involved in the making of that music, because they're just as important. And believe me, most of them really deeply appreciate somebody that cared enough to get their perspective, as well as the people that always get questioned and always a microphone in their face, you know?
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, as, you know, being a journalist, you have to pretty much do your own research. And a lot of time when I see some liner notes, they pretty much do researching from other previous projects. But one project I love, and I'm glad you gave me a shout out on, was the Phyllis Hyman album, Somewhere in My Lifetime. Oh my God,
yeah.
That album played a big part of my childhood, of the emotion in each depth of the song. I mean, it was beautifully arranged, and you know, her, that's being her debut under Arista, and then you took the critique and time out for this, because I felt it when you wrote the liner notes for it. So
was another one. Yeah, I talked to Barry Manilow and his co-producer. I've had too much champagne. But he did the Archies and everybody. He's a really cool dude, you know. I'm sorry, his name is escaping me. But, you know, yeah. But, you know, it's so funny. You have to take every relationship that you've ever had in your life and remember people. Because on my street where I grew up was a woman named Bess Brown, a percussionist and a copyist. And she went on the road with Barry Manilow for several tours. So when I wanted to reach out to Barry Manilow, I was able to say, Vanessa, this is my homegirl who was on my blog. Can you please put me in touch with Mr. Manilow? I only want 5 minutes with him to do blah, blah, blah. And that helped me, because if I had tried to go through normal channels to talk to Barry Manilow, I may or may not have gotten through to him, but my friend who played with him facilitated that for me. And so it was Ron Dante is the co-producer with Barry Manilow. Ron Dante, who, you know, was very much involved with a lot of bubblegum music, the Archies and all that kind of stuff. He and Barry worked together on co-producing that. And I made sure to talk to him too. I didn't just talk to Barry, the big name. I talked to Ron Dante as well, and so many people for that project. And you were very helpful to me, because I didn't have a copy of my original essay that I had written, because I wrote that essay twice.
Right.
That was a very different kind of project for me. I got to write it for one record company called Real Music, and they went out of business right when that record came out, and I never got any copies of it. But you had it because you were a fan, and I knew you through Facebook. I knew you were a Phyllis Hyman fan, and this is how we met. I said, man, do you have a copy of that project? You did. I think you sent me a PDF file or something of what I wrote on that essay, and this is why we're talking today. And now we're friends, you know, because
right.
I connected with you on Facebook, and we're both Phyllis Hyman fans, and you had that project. So it's very important to just really connect with people on a real level, because you never know how somebody can help you in life. And I mean, this goes beyond liner notes and work and stuff. This can be life, you know, it can be life saving, life changing. Somebody knows some information that can help you in a crucial time. That's what it's all about. This is what we all need to be about in this time when we're looking at our country being run by people that are not for us and that are selfish and greedy and power hungry. You know, it's really all about people loving and respecting other people. So I want to thank you on your show for being there for me in the moment when I needed you.
Right. And, you know, and then, like, we start, you know, connecting more, you know, start going in depth with the artists and stuff. So one other album that played a part in my childhood was Tina Marie and Must Be Magic.
Mm.
A lot of notes on that one. And when you,
oh, yeah.
When they reissued that one, I nearly fell out because that album meant a whole lot to me because it just takes me back to when I was young because me being young, I always looked at the liner notes who worked on the album, who sung background. I was real deep in it. So I was kind of like, I didn't have to go to any resource to look who did the album. Now I said, I know this album from front to back. And who worked on it, who was the session players, who was the background singers. But when you did the final and actually reached out to the people that was involved with the project, I was just, and you know I was ranting and raving about it when I found out that you did that. I'm serious because I told you it played a big part of my life. I said, what are you doing? You doing these albums that play a part of my life. Like I think it's some kind of kindred spirit. Like, wow.
Well, that's one of the things that I always take very seriously about music and records, because you, like me, and like most people, you know, your music is a very serious part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I go to the extra links that I do to tell those stories, because I know there's people like me and like you that really want to know the
exactly.
real stories behind songs, behind artists, what they were going through when they were making that record. You know, please take the time to talk to these people. And once again, Tina was a friend of mine, and, you know, it wasn't very hard for me to get her for those notes. And my dear friend, another late deceased person who's heavy on my heart, Lee Cadena, who was her manager off and on.
Yeah.
He was a friend of mine from Urban Network. You know, he connected me with Tina, although, you know, I'd known her for years. But, you know, Tina was special because Tina is the kind of artist who was always very appreciative and very, you know, much about giving acknowledgement to those that influenced her, that inspired her, that did everything. She was the first one of the first artists on Motown to, you know, actually be her own singer, songwriter, producer, arranger. When you bought the original copy of It Must Be Magic, it was full of liner notes. It had all of her lyrics, all of her special things, all of the musicians credited. I mean, you know, and that was unusual, because if you look at like a Switch record or a high energy record or whatever, you know, most artists didn't have the level of liner notes and credits and things
exactly.
that Tina had. So she already had a lot of depth. So it was my job to get her to talk about, you know, like putting her back in that time period and having her speak about what making that record was all about. It was a big deal for her. It ended up being her last record for Motown. It was her second record as a producer.
Yeah.
You know, she was really, really deep in, you know, and there's so many great, I mean, amazing songs on that album. Where's California, 365, Portuguese Love, Ballad of Cradle Rob and Me, and Yes Indeed, which closes out that record. I mean, they were just crazy, amazing songs. Yeah, great songs.
And then I didn't know Patrice Rushen worked on that track.
Yes, oh, wow. Indeed. She played all that amazing piano on Yes Indeed.
And then the way that it was detailed in the liner notes of how the piano was played in it, I was just like, wow, I never knew that she played it on there until I got.
But that was there. It was there in the liner notes. All you had, had to look, because Tina was the type of artist that made sure that you knew who did what on her records. And it's really interesting, and you might have seen on Facebook yesterday, I posted about a great guitar player who passed away named Harold Bean. And he was a really great guitarist, and he played on Isaac Hayes' album, Hot Buttered Soul. He did all the guitar work on Walk On By, which is a legendary song of black music. And that man went throughout his... Yeah, he went throughout his whole life pretty much. Very few people knew that he was the one that played that guitar solo because he wasn't credited on the record. That's the dichotomy I'm talking about. That's the dichotomy I'm talking about. That man
wow.
did not get his credit while
mm-hmm.
he was around. You had to. I interviewed Isaac Hayes, and so he, you know, I found out who did all that stuff. But most people, it's not on the record, and it's very sad that he went like that. But like again, Tina Marie was an artist who was sensitive enough, and you know, made sure that everybody that did something on her record, you know who played, you know, there's some cat named Christopher who played drums on Where's California or 365. It was Paul Hines that played drums on Portuguese Love. And it was all delineated so you knew precisely. And that's just the difference in people. And I love Isaac Hayes. I'm not trying to disparage him. I mean, very, very, very important person to me. But, you know, there was a thing back in the day where artists were very secretive about who they had playing on their records because they didn't want other artists to steal them or to take that sound. You know, like Maurice White, you know, he gave credit to all the people that played on his records, but he kind of regretted it when Phil Collins took his horn section and they went around the world and toured with him and got paid crazy money and played on Phil Collins records and stuff. You know, they were the Phoenix Horns, Don Myrick, Louis Satterfield, Romley, Michael Davis and Michael Harris, he felt some kind of way about Phil Collins taking his horn section and kind of taking that sound that was so known for Earth, Wind, and Fire and putting it in the Phil Collins pop rock context, you know. So that's the reason why certain people didn't want to let people know who their session musicians and stuff were because they didn't want them to steal their sound. So it's kind of a 360-degree perspective on that kind of stuff.
Exactly, because a lot of times that when like you said, that you go in depth of, you know, finding the artists that are participating in the projects, and a lot of times they don't get credit for it. And it
That's
has
right.
a lot to do with the label. It's not the artist half the time. But sometimes the artists do credit the artist by mouth verbally, but not written on the stone, which is the product. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
I mean, that's what lives on. I mean, early in my career, I did several individual little short liner note essays for the second box set that Motown did on their hit singles. And one of the ones that I was assigned was Switch, There'll Never Be. Now, when I was growing up, I remember that the guitar on that song was so amazing. You have a whole minute guitar solo before the vocal came in. When you go and look at the original album that song came from, Motown was in that era where they were, okay, here's all the musicians that played on the record. But there'd be like three, four, five guitarists, and they wouldn't tell you, it didn't delineate who played on what song. Do you know, I had to go to the Musicians Union on Vine Street in Hollywood, dig through a whole bunch of paperwork and files to find out that it was a brother named Michael McGlowery who did that
mm-hmm.
guitar solo. It was that important to me. It's like I wanted to let people know that that was the cat who played that guitar solo. And he was so appreciative, you know, and then I talked to him, I met him, you know, he's a Facebook friend of mine now. I don't even know if that brother's still doing music, but can you imagine? Again, this is a guy that played on a top 10 R&B smash record, and he's playing all this incredible guitar that gave brothers a whole 60 seconds to get a girl on the dance floor before the first words came in. And I set him up. I told that whole story like that, and he appreciated the fact that I did that. You know, that was some extra work I did because I wanted to know, and then I was able to let other people know.
Mhm. Yeah, because, like I said, you go in deep, and also you also did some compilations that I actually own. One of them is one of my favorite ones, the Minnie Riperton double CD, the Petals, College. Yeah, that one I love.
That is the hallmark of my entire career. That is a project that I not only wrote the liner notes for, I produced it, I pitched it. I had to pitch it to the record company, and then I had to pitch it to Dick Rudolph, who was Minnie Riperton's widow, or you know, husband, and father of their daughter, Maya. And he was turning down everybody at the time. You know, all kind of people were coming to him wanting to do books on Minnie, a movie on Minnie, or, you know, all kind of stuff. And he was like turning them down right and left. When I went to have my meeting with him, I took a book of breast cancer awareness stamps from the U.S. Postal Service, and I gave him a booklet, and I gave Tom Cartwright at the Right Stuff Records a book of the stamps, and I said, you know what? I want to illuminate this woman's story. I want people to know more about Minnie Riperton than she being the woman with the high voice that sang Loving You. I said, this woman has an amazing history, and I feel that she deserves not one, but a two-disc anthology that covers the entirety of her career from when she was, you know, Andrea Davis at Chess Records, and then a member of the Rotary Connection, and then she did the amazing album produced and arranged by Charles Stepney, Come to My Garden. Then she did the Perfect Angel album with Lovin' You on it. And then she did a couple more records, and then she died tragically of breast cancer. But before she died of breast cancer, she was a champion for letting people know that they needed to have women, letting women know that they needed to have their breasts checked. You know, she went on national television and told her story about having a breast removed and everything. All this stuff was important back then. Only like true fans of Minnie knew that stuff. But after we were able to do that project, which was out for 10 years, it's out of print right now. But I know for a fact that my essay and all the work that I did on Petals begat the Unsung episode that the Unsung people did on Minnie Riperton. They basically took the template of what I wrote in my liner note essay and turned it into a script for the Minnie Riperton Unsung, which I think was part of their second season. It's in the second season they did that. Yeah.
And I think like with that episode that they did, and I'm glad they included you with it. So when I saw the promo for it, I said, I know they need to put my friend on there, because when I start looking at it, it pretty much was the illustration of my notes, you know? And I think that was just like, wow, the timing of it, because the release of that too, because I bought it the day it came out. And then it was rounding up to the Unsung episode. So, you know.
A few years later, they did that Unsung. And I was very, that was one of those cases where I was very happy that somebody thought enough, because they could have just taken my essay and turned it into a script and not included me in it.
Right.
You know? But they actually reached out to me and they had me be a part of it. And I was very proud to be a part of it. I've been on 4 episodes of Unsung. I was on Minnie Riperton, Angela Winbush, Millie Jackson, and then most recently the Jets. And those were all very fun experiences for me. I thought the Minnie Riperton episode was a little overly sad. They spent a lot of time on her dying, which I would not have done that if I directed the episode. I would have. You know, Minnie was a really fun person. She was funny. She had a whole nother thing going on with her. And I would have wanted to illuminate that more. And they also missed something that was very important, which was the story behind Inside My Love and how controversial it was. They didn't touch that at all. And I didn't understand. That was a big hit for her. How could they skip that but spend like 2.5 segments on her dying. You know, it was like that episode didn't need to be that sad. But again, I'm glad that they did it. So many people love Minnie and know more about her now because of that. Television is something else. Television, I mean, I've done liner notes. I've done over 300 liner notes, Jay.
Right.
But being on Unsung and being on Celebrity Legacies, television's a whole nother level. People recognize me. I was in an airport one time, and somebody, a baggage handler, looked at me and said, I know you. I've seen you on television. You were talking about music or something. And I was like, yeah, wow. I couldn't believe it. Television is a whole nother level of recognition. People will remember you from that more so than liner notes, because in liner notes, they're just reading you. On TV, they see you.
Exactly. And also, when I had like a little gathering at my place, and so my friend, he's a music lover too, and we're Unsung fans, and he just kept looking at you. He's like, he's on Unsung. I was like, yeah, that's my good friend. I said, let me introduce you to him. And he was kind of nervous because he was like, oh, my God. Because when you get with a real music head that's out there pretty much, you know, stating what we like, it's an honor, you know, because we feel that, like, as us in these plateaus, that we try to find people like us. And then you are like the platform of a music head, you know, a real music head, because you just like us. We go in depth of everything involved of these projects and not just
right. What
you're saying. And with these projects that you put together, and another one you put together was the Brenda Russell one, the Ultimate Collection.
Brenda Russell Ultimate Collection, yeah.
The Ultimate Collection, yeah. And another one that I love and I'm still trying to save my change for is the Isley Brothers Complete RCA Victor and T-Neck Records Masters. I'm still trying to save my money for that one. Because
one is no joke. I think I forgot, was it 22 discs or something?
Yeah, 22
or 23 discs of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That was amazing. You know, Ernie Isley is a very, very dear friend of mine. And, you know, I had a really good time talking with him and Chris Jasper for that box set. And, you know, that was a whole bunch of albums that I had to write about in one package. And it was a challenge. Because I'm used to writing for one project and I can go all in. 23 albums in one box or something. I forget the exact spec of what that project was. You have to really edit and just really get to the core of each one of those individual projects. Unfortunately,
right.
Ronald Isley didn't make himself available to me for that project. But Ernie and Chris are really the ones that did a lot of the writing, as well as the late, great Marvin Isley. They're the ones for Isley Brothers stuff. I mean, before that, the older brothers, you know, back in the day, you know, they wrote songs. But once the young guys came in, most of all of that material from the 3+3 album, which had that lady on it, all the way through Between the Sheets and whatever, it was the younger guys that wrote most of the stuff. So again, they gave me just gold, you know, just gold, all their memories about that stuff, those sessions, writing those songs and the road and all of that. It was amazing. Only thing I'll say about that project, other than not getting, you know, Ronald not making himself available to me, which was disappointing, is that, you know, I really wanted to write an essay for that project, but I had to end up writing about each one of those albums in an individual fashion, which made it something that, you know, because I couldn't write an essay, you know, it wasn't eligible for Grammy consideration or anything like that. If I had been able to write like a 10 or 20,000 word essay, you know, I might have had a shot at getting, you know, some award recognition. But the way that booklet was put together, and I give a shout out to my friend Jeremy, who's working over at Sony at that time. He brought me in. It's just the way that they laid it out. I couldn't write an essay, so that disappointed me, because I could have gotten so knee deep with just Chris and Ernie about all of that stuff. But what I did get to do there for another record company was a liner note essay exclusively on the album Go For Your Guns. And I thank Ernie and Chris for that. And that's that is one of those albums that is perfect. There's very few perfect albums in the universe of music, but the Isley Brothers had two of them. One was The Heat Is On, and the other one was Go For Your Guns. There's not one superfluous moment on either one of those records. Right. Go For Your Guns is the pride, Footsteps in the Dark, Voyage to Atlantis, Climbing Up the Ladder, Living in the Life, Tell Me What You Need It Again. Ooh. You know, there is not any filler on that record. Every single song is great. That's right. Ernie and Chris broke me off on that one. And I also talked to my friend Nikki Richards for that project. She did a wonderful cover version many years later of Voyage to Atlantis from a woman's point of view. So I got her perspective on what that song meant to her. And it went into aspects of her family life and everything. So, you know, I would definitely have people seek that out. That reissue of Go For Your Guns that has that essay in it, because that is truly reflective of the way I do liner note essays.
That liner note, when I found out that they were reissuing it and you were doing the liner notes, I actually trying to grab a copy, because I already have it already. But I was like, I need to grab it because you did the liner notes on it, and you know, with them reissuing it, it was major, because that album was, like I said, a soundtrack in everybody's lives, especially mine. You know, that was like Saturday morning cleaning music, pretty much that whole album. That album had, no fillers. No fillers. It went straight.
No fillers. That was a great record. I'm trying to remember the name. I knew I shouldn't have had this champagne before I did this interview. But it's a record company I've only done a couple of things for. You know, I did a liner note essay on rock band The Tubes for that record company. Album called Outside Inside.
Uh-huh.
Oh my goodness, not Soul Music Records, it's not Real Music. I can't remember the name of it. But yeah, I mean, and that album has been reissued. That album has been reissued a couple of times. And so a lot of people felt like they already had it. But I plead with people, if you go and look on Google, find the version of Go For Your Guns on CD that has liner notes by A. Scott Galloway. I guarantee you, you will appreciate having that version instead of any other version that's been done on CD, if for no other reason than the fact that I got the stories behind all those songs from Ernie and Chris and Nikki. So, just look it up. You'll just get rid of the other one, take it to your used record store, give it to your grandkids or something.
No.
And also had some bonus tracks on it. I think it had just, some 12-inch mixes or something on there that also make it a nice bonus for you to have. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I did see that. So I'm actually cop that definitely and tell you my perspective, because, you know, I always read the liner notes. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thank you so much for coming on here and taking out your busy schedule, because I know you got stuff lined up already, so we're not gonna ask you. I just want to be surprised.
But the thing I will tell everybody is that I have a David Sanborn anthology that's coming out in a couple of months. This year is David in July. I think it's July 30th. David Sanborn will turn 75 years old. This is the 45th anniversary of him being a recording artist, and the project covers his 25 years on Warner Brothers, Reprise, and Elektra Records. And this is another project I'm very, very, very proud of. It's a three-disc anthology, and it really gets knee-deep into the three different aspects. The first disc deals with the early years in New York. The second disc deals with all of his R&B and funk-oriented material, primarily with Marcus Miller. And the third disc is deals with a lot more of his mood music, you know, some really deep jazz, blues, and avant-garde side of David Sanborn. So I think the project is going to be called Anything You Want, which is a song title of a song that he and Michael McDonald wrote together back on the Hideaway album. It's like Anything You Want, David Sanborn, the Warner Elektra Reprise years. So I'll be looking for that. I believe it's coming out in May. That's my next super project.
I'm really looking forward to that because I definitely need that in my collection too.
You do.
Oh, I thank you, bro, for coming out so much, you know, taking out
your
time.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
Because I've been wanting to do this with you because I we could go for hours. People don't understand. We could go to every aspect of what you did, every aspect. You know, we could go.
I want to congratulate you on your Soul Cravers Radio podcast, man. Keep doing your thing. Build your archive. I'm honored to be a part of it. I listened to your Sky Ladies of Sky episode, and I was very impressed. You know, you create a very comfortable atmosphere for people to just talk and chill and be themselves. And so keep doing your thing, man. I know I will see you and speak to you again in the near future.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I thank you guys for tuning in for Soul Cravers Radio. And enjoy the Super Bowl. Don't drink too much. I hope you go to work the next day.
Especially
you don't do too much either.
Well, you know, I'm already started, so I'm in trouble. But I'm having a ball, and I don't even watch sports, but I'm gonna be at a sports bar today with some beautiful ladies watching the game, so I'm gonna have a good time.
All right. Thank you guys for tuning in. See you in 1 hour. Well, actually 15 minutes when my next guest is LaToya Williams is coming up. So I'll see you guys in 15 minutes. Later.